Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 17th, 2003. Today's session is entitled Accompaniment. What would real solidarity in mission look like? Session 2 of Global Mission in the 21st Century, presented by Peter Nash. Let's listen in.
The couple of things to pick up from yesterday, but I want to talk mainly about solidarity and what that might mean, what I understand is solidarity, and how difficult it is for people from wealthy nations, whatever country, but especially now that we find ourselves as North Americans, U.S. citizens, as the world's only superpower. And I've been back in the States 2 weeks, but I've noticed that since, and I was in the United States a lot this semester as I looked for a job and did some guest lecturing. A couple of one university and one seminary this semester, which was an unusual thing for me. If you're here for the first time, my name's Peter Nash, so if you're looking for Marietta, that's not me. She's next door. And this is the second of three sessions on global mission in the 21st century. In these trips, unusually high number of trips to the States, I noticed that we're used to. We don't even shy away now from talking about the U.S. as an imperial power. We have been that for quite some time. We haven't owned up to it until quite recently. And so the subtitle for today is Can the Child of a Superpower Learn Not to Act Like a Superpower? How many were in Vespers last Wednesday when I pretended to preach? Okay, you all bear with me. I'm going to tell the story again because the story is about identity and owning one's identity, which was very important for me for my my 8 years in mission with the ELCA and the ESLA. For my growing awareness of it doesn't matter who you are, if you're a U.S. citizen, when you walk around, you just carry a whole lot of power with you, no matter if you want to accept it or not, you do. The story isn't quite so much about that, but I'll explain. The title of the story, or with the title fits, might help. In 1995, when I left the United States, I was an African-American getting on an airplane in Chicago at O'Hare Airport. When I got to Sao Paulo, I was no longer black. I was mulatto, moreno. Moreno, and around back there is moreno. Anybody with dark hair, dark eyes, is moreno. So you can be as dark as me or darker. If your hair is dark, your eyes are dark. Or if you're very light, you're moreno. I went to southern Brazil, and I was negro, black. Again, because it's the whitest, I explained yesterday, the whitest part of Brazil. Then in 1996, I went to a conference in Zimbabwe and found out, and I had to pass through South Africa, the new South Africa, 6 years new, found out that I was black in South Africa, the new South Africa, but foreign colored in Zimbabwe. That was December. I flew back to Brazil through Sao Paulo, where I was born, mulatto, moreno, back down south to my home, picked up my ticket to go up to the state where I was black again, came back up to the states to be with my kids where I was African American, went back to Brazil, you know the whole story. Then in 1999, I went to teach in Mozambique and spent 1 week in South Africa teaching there. I was black again. And then when I got to Mozambique, nobody talked much about race until I was ready to leave. And I went into town in Maputo, and I started to buy presents for everybody. You have to buy presents before we go someplace exotic. And because of my exquisite Portuguese, Brazilian Portuguese, the Mozambican saleswoman at the store, I decided to drop my money. Immediately knew that I wasn't Mozambican. I thought I could fool her because I spoke Portuguese, but no, she knew right away. And she charged me the tourist tax. And when I complained about that in the van going back to the school, one of the students looked at me and said, of course, professor. look at your white skin. Next time, take a black person with you. So I had become a white man in the third world. We joke a lot about that. We complain a lot about it. And some people feel victimized by, you know, the talk about dead white men and what the old curriculum and the modified curriculum, the curricula since the 60s. But there is, as we've talked about it within the United States, there's an awful lot of power. Some people have coined the phrase white privilege. You know, if you're a white male, pretty much the society is structured in your favor. If you're a North American, U.S., Canadian, not Mexican, of course, white male, but in some cases even Mexican, in Brazil, in Chile, in South Africa, in Mozambique, in Zimbabwe, just about any place else in the world, doors open up for you. What I didn't quite understand when I went to Brazil, because I went as a pastor, as a doctor of philosophy, doctor of philosophy in Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations, as a representative of the ELCA, I was pretty much just an American. I mean, it was one of the things that I had realized earlier, that when a black person, African American, travels outside of the United States, we get some American respect that we don't get in the States. And that's one of the reasons a lot of us like to travel, because we're Americans before we're black or African American, in many cases when we travel outside of the country. Well, that privilege that some of us accept or admit to in the U.S., it broadcasts throughout the world in a very powerful way. One funny comment was, about my third or fourth year, I still didn't have a car. I didn't have a cell phone. Brazil is one of those countries where the cell phone technology, with that leapfrog effect, it took so long to get, and it was so expensive to get a landline, that when cheaper cell phones came out, which was still, in my opinion, quite expensive, meant a lot of people jumped to get the cell phones because they could have the phone within a matter of weeks instead of a matter of 6 months, a year, 18 months. And the old system in Brazil, until about 3.5 years ago, is you had to buy stock in the phone company. So they had this leapfrog effect. People just ran out and bought cellular phones. Someone looked at me and said, "What? An American without a car and a cell phone? What's wrong with you?" This is the kind of image we carry with us, the kind of expectation that we have whatever we need, whenever we want it. And to a large extent, it's absolutely true. The first time I went out of the country, besides Canada, where we had families, the professor said to us, "When you go to this is in Jamaica, when you go to the beach, well, first of all, don't take anything valuable with you," he said, because they don't see it as a crime if you leave your watch on the beach. If they pick it up, they think you're going to go home and buy a new one. And guess what? You will. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And that's not just a watch. It's a digital recorder. It's all kind of stuff that we take with us. One of my colleagues from Union Theological Center, a colleague who teaches at Union Theological Seminary, came down to visit and lecture for us about 3 years ago. And I had to laugh because when she showed up, she stayed at our house for 2 weeks. When she showed up, in her fanny pack, she had about $4,000 worth of electronic equipment. There was a palm, there was her traveling palm pilot. There was a small Sony digital camcorder. I don't know what else, but it was just amazing. And I had to laugh because when I got to Brazil, I was carrying the 1995, well, I was actually carrying like the 1993 version because I'm kind of a cheap guy. The same thing, I had a camcorder that fit in my handy pack, and I had a small, point-shoot camera. And it's just who we are. We've got a lot of stuff. I don't know if anybody's a regular reader of the Litany Reader. Somewhere in the early 90s, before I had ever thought about going to Brazil, they ran an article about the average goods in households around the world. I think it was actually a coffee table book that someone had done. And the Brazilian home, they put everything, what they did was they went to homes and they took everything out of the home and put it in the front lawn. Yeah? And the Brazilian home was, you know, comfortable, you know. There was a Pakistani home, maybe Afghani, but somewhere up there in the stands of Western Asia. They had like six pots and firewood. That was everything the family owned. As you can imagine, in the median U.S. home, there was just an enormous pile of stuff out in front of a two-car garage. It was just, it was shocking. I mean, I grew up here. I lived here all my life, but it was shocking to see how much stuff the typical North American or U.S. citizen owns or has mortgaged himself or herself out for. Owns along with the bank. So, if you've got all this stuff, how do you imagine yourself into the place of someone who has a very modest pile of possessions? If your culture has taught you that all that you have is necessary, how do you imagine yourself into a situation where you don't have all that stuff that we think of as necessary? And I don't have any simple answers to that. I mostly want to talk about it with you all, rather than try to tell you how to do it, because I didn't know how to do it. I lasted 8 years, and I couldn't bear the thought of not being in a position of helping my children through college. Had I stayed in a position that made me financially superior to about 85% of the Brazilians, comfort in terms of financial comfort, I would have been in a situation where I could not have helped my boys go to university. So, you know, I'm not pointing fingers. I'm not saying bad us. Oh, at least when I point my finger and say bad us, I realize that I'm talking about myself, as well as all of my colleagues who have all that stuff. I was going to say something profound, and it got away from me, but I'm sure. I want to backtrack just a minute. Yesterday I talked about some projects, and let me just do a little parenthesis here. Talked about my project, but I didn't get very far into it because there were a lot of questions, a lot of interest in what Brazil was like. The project I worked on, if you want to hear what this Negritude na Bíblia e na Igreja is like, and from the biblical point of view, there are 5 sessions from last week that I did that you can listen to in the listening library. I finally cut a CD. the topics there are like the topics that we worked on down in Brazil. Another thing that Mission has done, that DGM has done in the last 10 years, is talk about South-South and regional cooperation, so that not all LCA, flashback, not all ELCA missionaries are members of the ELCA, nor are they U.S. nationals. There are many cases where people have gone from one southern hemisphere country to another to carry their expertise from one country to another with the support of the ELCA, from Argentina to Brazil, Brazil to Chile, Chile to Bolivia, Madagascar to
New Guinea and India.
Yeah. So a lot of South-South. Why is this kind of fits into what I want to try to talk about today, solidarity? Because in the past, what was absolutely necessary for, let's pretend that South America looks, whoa, it doesn't look anything like South America. Let's pretend that South America looks something like that. And how does that fit in there? Well, let's pretend Africa's over here someplace, and Europe is up here someplace, and the United States looks like that monster in the news media that's, the weather that's coming to attack us with rainstorms. In the past, seriously, and it still works this way to some extent, If I wanted to talk to somebody in Brazil wanted to talk to somebody over here in Peru, they come up here. They went to Philadelphia to the seminary, they went to Chicago to the seminary, and then the theological world. They went to Higgins Road and Amaretto meeting. Or they want to talk to somebody over here. They came up to Geneva, to the Lutheran World Federation for a meeting, for a conference. And there was none of this interchange. So everything had to be filtered through the U.S. and Canada and the various German and Norwegian and Danish and Swedish Lutheran churches. And we're thinking, if liberation theology has anything to offer, perhaps these people should be put in a position to talk with one another. These people should be put in a position where they are offering the mission and not just the receivers of mission, so that we begin to make it possible for them to eliminate their dependency, their total dependency on us for the air ticket and the ideas. Because what often happens is if who's paying the bill gets to determine the agenda. And for the meeting, and that wasn't working out. So I left Asia out of here just only because I've never been there. I'm really self-centered. Any questions or observations, clarifications up till now? It depends.
Could you repeat the question?
Has it been my experience that people in the Southern Hemisphere would prefer South-South mission cooperation because it hasn't been the questioner's, what is your name?
Cindy.
Hasn't been Cindy's experience. My experience has been mixed, quite frankly. One of the problems with the dependency that we've built in, that has been built into the old way of doing mission, the old way of doing aid in a lot of different situations, not just in the church, is that the missionary, the white guy and the white gal, become the point of walking money. So one of the reasons that I've seen that they would prefer me, the almost white guy from the United States, to him, the white guy, the real white guy from another Latin American country, South Africa, for example, which is fairly wealthy, is that I, in their mind, represent more aid.
DGM wants a South-South missionary from Tanzania. But when I was in Rwanda, they're like, no, we want somebody from USA. We don't want Tanzanian.
There's also national pride. There's also what we call, ethnic conflicts in some cases. I was a partial observer to, I observed for a time, situation in Mozambique where the Tanzanian leadership really took advantage of the position of leadership. And there was money flowing in from the Bavarian Lutheran Church, from the Zimbabwean Lutheran Church, and from the ELCA, and not all of it was making it where it was supposed to go. And so some of the Mozambicans were really fed up with South-South at that point. They wanted the good old system where the missionary knew he had a pension, and so the money didn't get diverted. And then there are some situations. This is an interesting conversation that I had with, that was interesting to me, you guys can be the judge, with a theological professor at the Lutheran Seminary in Hong Kong. We have a lot of theological missionaries, theological education missionaries. And I was making the point that we really need to back out and help them develop their own theology rather than spewing out for them the old Bart and Tillich and Luther and the way we learned it. What if they want Tillich and Bart the way we learned it? And that's what they want. you know, fine, let's see what happens when they mess with it, when they contextualize it for themselves. I was trying in Brazil to speed up that process for the Lutheran theology to become truly Brazilian and not imported from the United States and not imported from Germany. And there are lots of different opinions of it. So there are places where lots of places where people are not necessarily dependent, maybe called that sometimes, and I don't think most of us are kind of the judge of the people in that way, but where they have decided we want a classical theological education, we want a classical theological position, and you know, maybe another generation, or never, that they contextualize. There has been a myth of theological education that some people do contextual theological education, theology, and other people do basic theology. Well, all theology is contextual.
Yeah. Is part of it, though, that to be a part of the classical theology is to be part of, to be able to be a part of a discussion with the people in power. I mean, if what you perceive as North Americans have their theology, well, if we want to be in discussion with them, we have to know that language.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a big part of it. And I think that, that we have control, various we's, have control of various situations by the language we use by, that's a theological issue, you know, and you're talking about a practical issue, that this whole contextual theology, philosophical theology. You have to go through this tunnel, or this eye of the needle, if you want to get to the theological truth. Mm-hmm. And there's really no other way except for through Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota, or Southern Seminary in Columbia, South Carolina, or, you know, Heidelberg, or whatever.
It's like, you know, privilege and ideas in a certain way.
Yeah.
I mean, I would imagine that people outside of North America would feel that they might not be listening to it. And that they haven't been listening. If they're not part of this discussion.
Mm-hmm. Or that they're continuing to be treated as second class members of the church. Let me defer this until tomorrow, because if we talk about this too much tomorrow, I'll be talking tomorrow about what I was hoping to talk about today. But that
I won't be here tomorrow. That's probably why I'm pushing.
But that is part of what I learned from theological education and talking about the theological educators. Who have been working for DGM and for other mission societies, and for people from people who were engaged in indigenous theological education. But this puts on the table for us a question of power, questions of survival. So let's try to think for a few minutes about what we think of when we hear the term solidarity. Solidarity, a common idea for you all? Or?
I think of at least attempting to set down my assumptions and presuppositions in order to seek understanding from another's point of view. Knowing that I might not be able to have perfect understanding.
What else?
Solidarity to me is with rather than over or under. I think of.
This is not the communion formulation in with and under, but. Mm-hmm. A posture of mutuality.
Mutuality, and, definitely.
And,
I think my labor union.
Labor union.
I've usually heard it in terms of being in solidarity with and the companion for me. Not just as amorphous mountain.
solidarity with everybody. It suggests that you're against, but you're and with in solidarity.
It implies action as well.
Is this too much to say against a common opponent?
Mm-hmm.
Anything else?
Yeah, I think of it as an exchange where, although on the surface the exchange is not equal, it's accepted as equal by the people who are making the exchange.
Can I say an exchange that obliterates the inequalities?
Yeah. I'm thinking, for example, if I did something for somebody because that was my skill, and in return they gave me a glass of water, I would have to call it an equal exchange because the water is what they had to give and I had what I had to give. And we're in solidarity because we've made an exchange that I see as equal.
If you're in the desert and they're giving you water, it's a whole different context. Christine had some.
Well, I was thinking along the same lines, just wondering how much flow there is. Among the parties or between the parties who are seeking to stand in solidarity with each other. And partly I was thinking about, you know, we talked about north, south, 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 but I'm really intrigued by south, north, too, as one of the mission fields that we in North America are a mission field for people in Tanzania and in Madagascar and in some of these countries that, as I talk to people, you know, Christians in countries like that, they look at our church and our nation and say, we need to hear the gospel again in new ways, and we want to come and help you hear that. That's standing in solidarity, too, I think. But just how much flow, it's not just us.
And well, you said how much flow, but I put here, is this different from what you said, reevaluating the direction of?
I can't read what you're writing.
Can anybody read what I'm writing?
Sorry, I'm far away.
I put down here, reevaluating the direction of the flow. So we're not assuming that it's all going one direction. Or that, again, that it's not a, that the measure of equality is different when we talk about solidarity. Is that fair?
Yeah.
Anything else? Who or what is, we've got labor unions as one model for solidarity. Anything else come to mind? Or anyone else come to mind for a model of solidarity?
Church.
Church? Can you be a little more specific?
What you would believe, so like a Catholic church or a Presbyterian group or a Lutheran?
Where does the church show its? Where do the churches or the church
congregation
in the congregation? Okay. Over here, and then in the back, and then in the front.
I think probably like protests, direct action kind of stuff is a form of solidarity. The church people sometimes get involved in, and labor union people sometimes get involved in.
Mm-hmm.
I think of accompaniment projects, like Christian peacemaker teams and international solidarity movement, people who are doing that in responsible ways.
I spoke about it again. What are those projects do? Peacemaking projects that you're.
Yeah, so folks go to Israel-Palestine, they go to different, in the 80s there was lots of folks in Central America, and It's usually a white European, sometimes people of color from the Western world that go and flash their blue passport if you're from the United States and stand in solidarity with people who are in danger for one reason or another. So for example, in Israel-Palestine, there are people who walk with Palestinians because the U.S. government is giving Israel aid, so it's generally a bigger deal if...
So I'm the target.
Okay.
And so Jim comes down. Jim,
we're in solidarity.
Last week I called Jim Tim all week. I'm sorry. So the Reverend Thomas comes down and walks with me because they won't shoot at me with take a chance they're going to hit him. Mm-hmm. Well, that's some serious solidarity.
Mm-hmm.
We did that all over the Central American West Bank.
Mm-hmm. No, we'll both be shy.
Yeah. but that was the risk that these people take and took, that we'll both be shot at. The young woman who was crushed by the bulldozer a couple months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they know that at least if a North American or a European gets killed, it will get on the news. One more
sure.
Palestinian, well, he probably had a bomb wrapped around his waist anyway.
Yeah.
One more Sandinista, or former Sandinista, or future Sandinista, well, he probably was going to steal something, somebody's property anyway.
The Sandinistas, that's what I was thinking about, because we have sister city relationship with the Sandinista community, and a group in Colombia. Been going on for years and years. People have gone down there, and they now have a program through the college where students go down and get their language immersion and help try to build water systems in the community. That's in solidarity with these people to have it make possible for them to have a real life. They don't have any jobs. Possible
for them to be self-sustaining. Who is the church's model for solidarity?
Jesus.
Why?
He's the one that told us.
Because he's how did he tell us?
His actions.
So let's back up a little bit on this Jesus guy. I'm way on a limb here because I'm an Old Testament professor. Let's tell them talk about this Jesus guy. Only when I put the collar on, and that is very rare. Who is Jesus?
Well, he ate with the unacceptables. He entered their houses.
Let's go back just a step for a
He's
couple
the
steps.
Son of God.
The Son of God, which is another way of saying God. God became one of us. That's real solidarity.
Stay on the line
and die.
Stood on the line, got hungry, got sweaty, got tired, got crucified. Now this last part, everyone has to make his or her personal choice about what one can really give up. And I'm not, like I said, I could do 8 years, and then I had to think about how I was not sacrificing my stuff anymore, but my children in this culture, if they didn't have the means to go to college. Everybody draws their line someplace different. Although, I'd be the first one to judge some people, but... it won't be you, don't worry. Yeah, it won't. Our tradition tells us in its most striking form that God became one of us. God walked among us. God felt what we feel. God suffered what we all will suffer in order to make possible life with us. To make possible relationship with God. And that to me has to, God, for somewhere around 33 years, accompanied us in a very concrete way. That's not the only place. I mean, the whole Hebrew Bible is full of God. I like to tell my students that the New Testament is for slow learners. The whole Hebrew Bible is about how God tried to make contact, God tried to accompany us, God was in solidarity with us. God called us to communion, God called us to relationship, and we just didn't get it. So, well, what do you do when they don't get it? You come. You know, you show up. You know. Why couldn't the Israelites have slaves? Because you yourself were slaves in Egypt. You know what it's like to be in this position, so how can you possibly put somebody else in this position? This is our model. Or this is the model that I try to use. Not a what would Jesus do kind of model, but Jesus did this out of one context, and we live in another context, and we need to figure out how we too can do it. So for me, there was a kind of a funny process in Brazil, learning how to walk as that North American U.S. citizen, how to figure out the balance between, you can't ignore it, you can't pretend it's not there. You walk into a room, people look to you for certain things. And at every point I had to decide, well, which part of me are they looking at? I had to try to figure that out, and that took some time to know which ones were looking at, seeing me as the route to the ELCA money or some other money, other funds in the United States, or a fellowship to go study in another country or a door out of Brazil altogether. And which ones were really looking for partnership, and this idea of getting out of the dependency, it's really a tough thing. When you've lived in a model of dependency, codependency, enabling dependency, insisting on dependency, to have people come along and say all of a sudden, okay, we're equal partners. I mean, try to imagine that. If you've moved through situations where you were a junior partner in some sort of relationship, you were the student and then joined the faculty with your old professors. And how long it took you to own that you were in fact a colleague and no longer simply learning from the people who have once been your professors. Those of you who are clergy, how long did it take you to grow into the clergy role? You got through seminary, fine, you proved you could study, you proved that you could answer the questions of the ordination exams. And then they put you in the parish, and suddenly you're not the person anymore, you're not the seminarian anymore. Be the pastor. It takes a while to grow into that role. In a situation where everybody knows or everybody believes that this person has the root to the money, root to the power, the language I need to acquire, the stamps I need to get the visa. And then in a culture where people are just enormously polite. The U.S. culture is a culture that likes to see, doesn't have any problem saying no. I hear, it's funny, I hear people teaching their 7-8-year-old sons, no means no. In all sorts of situations, a friend told me about a 30-year-old friend went to a pool party and the kids got a little rowdy, all the kids were boys. And she said, that's enough. And the kids want to keep playing. And the mom said, when a woman says no, it means no. And these kids were like 8, 10, and 12. seemed a little early for that comment. That I was lost. What was the point I tell that story? It was going towards something. It seemed to go towards something.
The Portuguese,
the Brazilians are enormously polite. And so when you ask for something, they will all, even if they don't think you're going to give something, they will just try to make you happy. If you're a guest, they'll try to make you happy. If they don't know the answer, they'll give you an answer that they think you want to hear. That happens some places in the States, but most places, we talk. If you don't know, ask, and try to get to the right answer. So you go down there. I went down there, and people, they call it a game of the waist of the belt. I said Brazilians are always sort of like this. Dodging, trying to get out of the way of whatever authority might be coming down the road to make them do something that they don't really want to do, but they're not going to say, "I'm not going to do it." So you work your way into the culture, and it takes a while, but you're always sort of half in and half out, Where do they know that? When do they know that they can rely on you? Is the question. Because in my case, and in most cases in ministry, mission ministry, we have a ticket home. And when did the war start?
Which one?
This last one.
February.
So. December, January, we were getting letters from BGM.
March 17th,
St. Patrick's Day. Better than Martin Luther King's birthday. The last one. Yeah. We're getting regular messages from DGM. Make sure the car is ready. Make sure the tank is full. Make sure that all four wheels, you rotated the tires. Did you get out? You guys get all this stuff too?
Yeah.
Actually, this stuff was only for these guys, but they sent it to everybody. Mm-hmm. Well, not just for in Palestine and in the Arab world, but also for Africa, for the high Muslim concentration. Because this stuff came from the State Department, and it's BGM's sort of legal responsibility to pass it out to all its employees who could be considered at risk.
Well, I was just going to say that this is exactly at these kinds of circumstances that brings up the whole question of what does solidarity really mean. We've talked for 5 years about accompaniment in Palestine, and then the day before the war started, where we had already fulfilled DGM's request for a contingency plan about how we would stay and how we would essentially hibernate if necessary, if things were difficult in Jerusalem, which it turned out they weren't. We got a call from DGM saying, "We have tickets for you booked on Lufthansa tonight. Be at the airport." And we were able to change that at the last minute. And we did have solidarity in that sense, in that we called Bishop Medin Yunan and asked him to intervene for us with DGM and say that he needs us there, and it was furthermore, we would be safe. Mm-hmm. But up until that point, we have tickets for you on Lufthansa tonight. Yeah.
And that's a complicated situation that most of us who have been or who are in the field are frustrated by. We don't get to make some of those important decisions about how solidarity will be lived out in those pressing points. Some not so pressing points as well, but in this sort of a situation where they call and say the tickets are ready, in 2002, every missionary in Madagascar was pulled because of this political situation. I would bet that there's nobody left in Liberia from the Presbyterians, the Methodists, the Lutherans, the Anglican Church right now. Because the church has to worry about, the church is, I think, sincerely worried about my health, the health of its employees abroad, but they're also very concerned about, if I die, will my sister, mother, brother, children would sue. But find anything that proves that they didn't do everything to warn me about the possibility of life-threatening danger. And that's too bad because some, again, everybody makes the choice. The Thomases wanted to stay, and they found a way to stay. Other people, accompaniment goes up until, depending on where the children are and all sorts of different things. So I don't want to put too heavy a judgment on one who would leave, and certainly not on one who would choose to stay. It's tough, but the point is, you spend 5 years talking about accompaniment, which is the DGM model for the past 6 or 7 years. But then we have to act like a corporation.
What if they just didn't go?
What if people just didn't leave when they were...
Yeah.
I would imagine they get a stern letter and a threat that their employment will be terminated. And then that's how do you live in that sort of situation? Some people have got ways to live, and other people don't.
I'm sure you would have been told that DGM had no liability for our action. So often for diplomats and other people who work under USAID, if they decided to stay, you were given one chance to leave. And if you didn't take that chance, then they had no liability. They couldn't promise they'd be able to help you.
The problem, it seems to me, in some ways, is that then solidarity or accompaniment becomes simply an individual act, one that comes down the wire, which is fine. That's important. We all have to make our own decisions. But it seems like the power in solidarity could come from organizations and institutions that are willing to take it on.
And take it on with the people who are,
yeah.
not to say you've got to stay, but to say once
we
they
will
stay.
Support you.
Yeah.
And we, it's not just that we will support you, but that our organization is built around this idea. And I don't know how to describe it.
Yeah. Frankly, DGM, the Presbyterian Board of Mission, the Anglican Mission Board, the Methodist Board of Global Ministry, they all have a problem in that the churches have become corporations. And they're very concerned about lawsuits, they're very concerned about bad press.
I understand that, but I think it goes broader than the church. I mean, it's that the power of solidarity would really come from organizations, groups of people, institutions being able to take it on as a defining organizing principle.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately. Let
me raise a challenge to that in just a minute.
I just wanted to suggest, though, also in the case of the Vision for Global Mission, that using this accompaniment model, not only when they use that model, but when the local people with whom you have established a relationship potentially are in more of a burden having you there than having you leave, if there's some sense that they don't have the energy and the people and the whatever to watch out for your safety as a foreigner, or that you might draw some unfavorable activity their direction by your being there, that there's that to consider as well. The partner churches, the partner organizations have some say also in whether or not one stays in that situation.
I want to turn the, what time is it?
About 7:10.
We've got about 10 minutes. So I want to turn it make a nasty question. Is solidarity a U.S. value? Is solidarity, as we've begun to describe it here, begun to define it, is this a core value of the United States?
No, I think of it as official circle. The term solidarity is looked upon as being a vocabulary of radical anti-establishment population.
I don't know where you said of the government.
Of the government? You said U.S. Are you talking government solidarity? So the government has solidarity with other people?
Then we do the professorial thing and then make it another question.
Okay.
Do you identify the U.S. with the U.S. government?
Huh. Yes. Yeah, unfortunately, yeah.
That's a really interesting thing that we need to be aware of. One of the reasons so many American U.S. citizens stay alive around the world is because most people that I've talked to do not identify U.S. citizens with the U.S. government.
Oh, they don't?
Yeah. No.
How can they not?
Because they don't identify themselves with their own government.
Oh.
The difference between the citizenry and the government is quite distinct in most of Europe, in Latin America, very strong, so in Africa, in many places.
That's a good thing.
And so, you know, they look at U.S. citizens and they, on a case by case basis, where does this person fit in relationship to the U.S. foreign policy? And they know that a lot of the U.S. citizens who are expats. Are expats precisely because they disagree with U.S. foreign policy, U.S. government policy, and are working to ameliorate some of the damage that the government does. Was there another comment back here?
Well,
so
I think I understood your question maybe differently, but I understood you to be asking a solidarity, a North American value or concept, cultural, not in terms of government.
No, I wanted to play with the idea of the distinction between the government and citizenry, but there's still it's clear that it's not a U.S. government policy or value. But I still want to ask the question: is it a value that North Americans, U.S. citizens, highly esteem?
In different ways, in different circles. You know, the picture that comes to my mind is the WTO
World Trade Organization.
Yeah, demonstrations in Seattle a couple years ago, and the masses of people that came together to say that they were against what the WTO was.
Isn't that just a fraction? Just a minute fraction of the people in the United States that actually support that?
So
I mean, in the capitalist society, I don't see how you can have solidarity with other cultures when you're drawing from those other cultures and you're overpowering the other cultures.
Hold that thought. My boss is up there with her hand up and going,
I don't want that. No, I hear...
You've heard about me.
This is just anecdotal, of course, but I sense among a lot of middle-class Americans that they're grateful they live here and not any other place in the
yeah.
world.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how you can have solidarity with anybody else
yeah.
and have that be one of your thoughts,
that's
you know? And I hear that a lot from good Christian people.
They say
a lot about the world and very generously, but they're grateful that they're in this country.
I am glad that I'm in the United States with a job with health insurance and not without.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not even about within this country.
It's within certain circles within this country. It's a class thing, too.
Mm-hmm.
But
I might add race and gender.
Well, I was just going to say that not only is it challenging in terms of thinking about solidarity with other peoples, how can we, in light of what seems to be happening in U.S. society, that solidarity, say within a company organization 40 years ago, would be an assumed value, and now I think we'd be foolish to have any notion of solidarity within a corporate institution, because you might be out next week.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know that you're going to have a pension. You don't know that you're going to have health care. Why have solidarity is a value you can't afford.
Yeah, and I think there was a sense of solidarity in the labor movement until, say, the last 15 or 20 years, in which when the longshoremen went out, the Teamsters would go out. There was a sense of the, you know, or the, at least there was some sense that if they didn't band together, you know, they would fall individually, and maybe even longer ago than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm gonna push on this. So I got hooked in by a radical element in my personal life, and I kind of looked at Denmark a lot. Maybe not that they're models, but not that they're perfect. I grew up in a union town, grew up in a GM town, and I used to think it was pretty cool, and they did a lot of good things, but you know, all the unions work for union members. And in Brazil, it's really striking. This company's union has a really nice place in the country where they can have their picnics. In my hometown, this union, you know, the pipe fitters had a place where their members could go and have their weddings and bar mitzvahs and whatever, and this union had their place. If you weren't a member of the union, you had no place to go. You had to rent someplace high price, and in my growing up, guess what? There are a whole lot fewer. I mean, Richard Nixon used the race issue to break the unions in Philadelphia. Some of us are happy about that because we finally got in unions, and then the unions fell apart in the Reagan administration. The unions in Scandinavia have tended to say, we don't want this for union workers, we want this for our culture. Now, of course, some unions have more members in Denmark and Norway have citizens. so that's an argument that we can always fall back on, while they've got so few people. But schools, education, higher education, medical benefits, you know, unions are out there fighting for medical benefits for the union members. Well, why didn't our unions fight for medical benefits for every citizen of Saginaw, Michigan? Everybody, a hospital that serves everybody. No, we want to make sure that we have private insurance paid through the UAW for UAW workers. So, you know, growing up capitalist, it's kind of hard for me to go to Brazil and, you know, understand a sense of solidarity that's different from the union town mentality. It took me a long time to work through this question, and then quite seriously took Mary the Dane to have this kind of hammered away. The first couple of years, I said, well, you went to school for free? No. My parents paid for my school for 20 years before I got there. It wasn't free. The Danish people, the Swedish people, the Norwegian people pay every payday about 50% of their salary to make sure that their kids have a chance to go to school. To make sure when they fall ill, every Dane, every Swede, every Norwegian has the opportunity to go to the hospital.
What's their, looking back on that system, what's the wage gap now in Denmark, in Norway, between the wealthy class and the working class?
It's growing right now between the highest and the lowest. It's growing mostly because of immigration and the new immigration laws and the attempts to put the brakes on immigration.
So it's different than the way it's growing here in the United States.
It's different, but it's always been bad in the United States. Wouldn't we like 500, 600?
Not the way it is now. I mean, it's growing exponentially almost. And, well,
It's growing now, but yeah, you know, just name a few names that we all know: J.D. Rockefeller, you know, J.P. Morgan, you know, from the before income tax, the good old days of the robber barons.
Those good old days aren't gone. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry too.
Yeah, I mean, oh well, it's okay.
No, but I think the point is that, and it's, I think it's true, the concentration of wealth in the United States and the concentration of the fewer number of companies that are concentrating wealth is, I mean, you're right, you know, during the robber baron years there was a concentration, but it wasn't as intense as it is now in relationship to the total population.
And they're worldwide families and worldwide corporations now. The robber barons still were here in the United States. They were only robbing their own. Now it's worldwide. I mean, those families and people own those companies, it's worldwide robbery now. And that's why it's growing so rapidly. Well, I mean, my estimation.
So it used to be, I mean, isn't that it wasn't, we weren't exploiting, you know, South and Central America using, you know, the United States.
This is one.
Let me kind of do a quick, dirty, I hope funny version of history of mission. Missionaries, you know, the cross and the sword, and the kind of idea that missionaries went to civilize, to help pacify as the great crusade, great explorers, conquistadores, traveled throughout the world in whatever direction we're traveling, whatever period. And that sort of began to stop in the 1950s. By the 1970s, lots of mission fields were saying, enough, don't send us anybody in Africa. They said 1975, for 5 years we went on moratorium, don't send any more personnel. Send us some money if you want, but don't send any more personnel. Let us begin to work this stuff out for ourselves. The story that a Baptist preacher who was receiving an award told at a university graduation about salesman, and he applied it to mission endeavors, which is sort of the way it worked. Gentleman, first representative of his shoe company, went to Africa and got there, saw that nobody was wearing shoes, sold a couple boxes of shoes, and came home. Yeah. Second one went, saw that nobody was wearing shoes, sold, you know, a couple crazy shoes, and then went home. Third one came, saw that nobody was wearing shoes, sent a wire, we need boatloads. Send boatloads. Yeah? We're going to tell these people that they need shoes. Yeah? That's a lot of what we've done in mission. We've begun to change that, but let me say this as an I statement. One of my, and I joke a lot, that I was the last great mission imperialist act from the ELCA, because two guys sat down and said, these Germans need to learn something. These Teotihuacan Brasileiros need to learn something. Let's send them a black guy who can teach them about black theology. He'll begin to open up the church. It was our North American values being exported to Brazil, Brazilian movement. I went because I happen to agree with this guy. But I have no illusion that it wasn't an imperialist act. There were people who were ready for me to come, people who were inviting me as well. But point is, we get used to thinking that we have the right to decide for us. And we send that out, sometimes consciously, sometimes unconsciously. In my case, I think it was fairly well planned and fairly well planned. In other cases, it's not much different in form, certainly in scale, to what we did 100, 150 years ago, where we went out there and imposed our values. Now, as we talked about here in the case of solidarity, our values are mixed. Solidarity for some of us is really a value, and sometimes it's just, in some places, it's not. It's just not a part of our culture. So how what we do when we get there, how we see ourselves, can we sit and listen long enough to see who we are in this new place, is a very important part of the process for me. And fortunately, I had a couple of years to just teach Old Testament. But I got to tell you the funny story about that. As I walked, I taught a seminar on the use, abuse, and neglect power of the Hebrew Bible. I taught it for 3 years. I taught it at the traditional Methodist seminary where I taught for 11 years. I taught it in a not-so-traditional process theology, which means they think in a whole different philosophical scheme from the one I've been raised in. New process theology, Alfred North Whitehead. First time I taught in California, I was just shocked because I didn't understand the questions, because process theology asks different questions from traditional theology. I went to Brazil, where they were all liberation theologians. They asked questions that I could not understand for the first year. I tried to divide the room. Who would support King David and the need for power, the need for organization? And who would take the other side? You know, kind of separate debating class. In the United States, process theologians, traditional theologians, I'd always get, you know, about half the class defending the need for power, at least theoretically in the structure, and defending the need for freedom and individuality. In Brazil, everybody was clear. No one would take the position of the need for a structure imposed on people. So I had to sit, and that was just that was before I even got the question addressed. That story, I know, bell rang, just one more joke. Yeah, bear with me. Sociologist says to his colleague, the anthropologist, I'm going to get these people to jump in the lake. He's got a German, a Frenchman, a Brit, and a Brazilian. You guys know this joke?
Yeah.
So he says it's all about culture and understanding culture, listening and knowing what they value. So they bet, and then the sociologist goes up to the German, whispers in his ear, and he marches out, jumps in the lake. Goes over and talks to the Frenchman, whispers in his ear, he dallies out, jumps in the lake. Talks to the Brit, stiffens up, walks out, steps off the pier into the lake. Talks to the Brazilian, looks over his shoulder, really jumps in the lake. He comes back to his colleague, pays him, and says, how did you do that? What did you say? He said the same thing to everybody. He said, oh, of course not. Well, what did you say? Well, I told the German that it was the law. I told the Frenchman it was the fashion. And I told the Brit that it was tradition. And I told the Brazilian that it was prohibited. So, thanks for your attention. I'll see you at best.